rising, oscillating power supplies. So I had a little bit of a feeling for the importance of those things. And that's part of what went into those B-1 bomber power supply voltage regulators. Let's see now. I'm going to give you guys a couple of words about the Large Hadron Collider, which Paul did mention. And that is one hell of a machine. If you get a hold of a book called The Quantum Frontier, The Large Hadron Collider, it's a 2009 book, and you'll enjoy it. Rather well written. And if you look at what is that machine doing, it is one of its modes of operation is it makes a whole lot of bundles of protons and accelerates them at very close to the speed of light.
One repeater, time out.
99.9999%, so to speak. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 or 8 9s in a row followed by a 1 is the percentage of the speed of light they get out of those protons. And it's in that ring, it's accelerating bundles of protons going clockwise, bundles of protons going counterclockwise. Each bundle contains 100 billion protons, and there's 2,808 bundles. When the machine is running at full speed, it can squeeze into that ring that's 27 kilometers in diameter, 3,800 of these bundles, but it's got 2,808 bundles because they intentionally put some empty spaces in between, because every so often they need that time to reset detectors and things like that. Each of these bundles are really strange-looking things. Each bundle is 1 foot long, actually 0.3 meters long, but I call it a foot long, and a diameter of less than a millimeter. So if you could see a bundle with your eye, it would look like a very thin piece of spaghetti, the dry spaghetti before you cook it. It's a very thin kind of spaghetti. It's roughly a foot long, and roughly a fraction of a millimeter in diameter, and each bundle looks like that. 2,808 of them are going around that ring with spaces in between them of 25 feet, 25-foot spaces, 7.6-meter spaces between those bundles. So you have these things that look like spaghetti, dry pieces of spaghetti, before you cook it, moving at very close to the speed of light, just a couple of meters slower than the speed of light around that ring, 2,800 of them. Let me drop at 4 or 8, I'm not sure which, places around the ring. They allow the clockwise ring and the counterclockwise ring to encounter each other, to cross over each other, right in the middle of a detector. And some of these detectors are about as big as a house. And they can measure, after the collision, they can measure the speed, the polarity, the magnetic field, the direction of deflection, the energy, or measure almost everything you want about the particles that come out of that collision. But here's the strange part. When they fully load up the machine and they fully get it running, you set up all of these positive going clockwise and counterclockwise going protons. You've got them packed as close as you can get them together in diameter in the middle of this vacuum tube. And once you set it all running and they're colliding with each other, you would say, gee, they're going to collide a couple of times and it's all over. As tightly as you pack those protons, because of the diameter of the protons being so small, and you think you've packed them real tight, but there's a lot of empty spaces in between, one bundle going clockwise and one bundle going counterclockwise folds through each other, and you get very few impacts of those 100 billion protons per bundle. You load up the machine, you've got them continuously colliding at 4 or 8 positions around the ring, clockwise and counterclockwise, and you let that go on for the next 24 hours. Ain't that amazing? And even then, you've got a hell of a lot of those bundles left over that never contributed to a collision. Let me drop. The total amount of energy you put into those bundles that you can just barely see is 350 megajoules. When you have to dump that beam because something went wrong and it went out of focus and you want to get rid of it in a hurry, you dump it into this carbon pile. You have an opening somewhere where you deflect it real fast into a dummy load, so to speak. How much energy goes into that dummy load? That 350 megajoules has the ability to melt 1/2 ton energy is in that beam, you rapidly get the idea that if anything goes wrong with those deflecting magnets, so that you don't keep the beam not only well focused, but right down the center of that vacuum tube, and it starts deviating a little bit off to one side and starts encountering the tube, or even going through the tube and hitting the magnets, because it has the beam has the ability to melt half a ton of copper. You really want to make sure it stays well focused. And what Paul was also telling us about is that the magnets are now, let me drop them. The superconducting magnets are getting stronger and stronger as the way they're starting to use them at full capability. Tremendous amount of stored magnetic energy goes into those superconducting magnets with the liquid nitrogen and liquid helium that cools them down to a couple of degrees Kelvin in order to keep them superconducting, because you couldn't possibly power all those magnets if they were not superconducting. There's not enough power in the country of Switzerland and France combined to keep that thing going if it wasn't superconducting. And cooling it would also be another big problem. So the amount of energy in those magnetic fields is way beyond the energy that's in the beam itself. So the word high-energy physics is really a euphemism, if you know what I mean. There's a hell of a lot more of these funny little facts that I'll collect by reading this book and tell you guys about it later. But what a machine. And one of the main reasons people ask, why in the world are you doing this? Let me drop it. Because those air molecules that are in the room with you right now are moving 500 meters per second, 1.5 times the speed of sound. And all of those air molecules, each individual air molecule, if you could track it, is bumping into another air molecule something like 8 billion times per second. But every one of those bumps is a perfect bounce, no absolute 0.0 energy lost, because the very strong magnetic field of the cloud of electrons around one air molecule sees the cloud of electrons around the other air molecule, and that very strong electrostatic repulsion, opposite, I mean equal polarity repulses, therefore they come close to each other, and the electrostatic field sense each other, and they bounce off, and nothing happens. You make this particle accelerator so that your protons or your molecules, whatever you're using, you have to move them fast enough so that they can overcome that electrostatic repulsion and really hit each other for the first time. Other than that, you get a non-reaction. You get no information. And all the information you get is indirect. I mean, in theory, I could build a watch so small that I can't even see the parts of the watch. And in theory, I could smash it with a hammer and then take a microscope and look at all the parts that are left over and try to figure out what the original watch was. That's a very poor example, but that's sort of what these guys are doing. You can't see molecules. The best electron microscope you got cannot see them. And if you can't even see a molecule, and the proton, the nucleus inside of a molecule is 100,000 times smaller in diameter than the molecule, than the atom. You can't even see the atom, and the thing that you...
Repeater, time out.
Because I missed something, I'm here back.
You can't even see the atom because it's so darn small, and the nucleus that you care about, you'd like to envision it, it's 100,000 times smaller in diameter than the atom. You just simply Google the word helium and look at that diagram and study the dimensions that they've given you. It's roughly one angstrom in diameter, 10 meters, and 100,000 times smaller is the nucleus. And so you want those nucleuses to hit each other. It's a microscopic, sub-microscopic target trying to hit another one just like it. And so with the best focusing you've got of the most number of particles you can gather, you get very, very few collisions. Very, very similar to what happens when a galaxy smashes into another galaxy, because the spaces between the stars are so great, 99.99% of the time, they just fall through each other with no impact. And it's sort of what goes on. The actual dimensions of all of this and the velocities and the energies are just numbers that are out of sight. Now, when it comes to generating X-rays, the conventional way you generate X-rays, for instance, your x-ray of your teeth to make the x-rays hard enough that they easily penetrate the enamel of your teeth and leave a shadow where your amalgam fillings are, and you see a little bit of that shadow in the case of where the portion of the tooth is missing because of a cavity, to generate enough energy in those x-rays requires something like a few hundred thousand volts to be accelerated. You're accelerating those electrons from the equivalent of an electron gun, a cathode, and you smash them into a usually titanium target. I said titanium, tungsten target. The reason they choose tungsten is because it can tolerate real high temperatures without melting. But you've got the stream of electrons at these extremely high velocity of 100,000 volts smashing into the target. It's going to create heat. And it better be something that can tolerate the temperature. So at a 45-degree angle, these electrons smash into that tungsten target, and what you get out of that tube is something you and I call x-rays. And by various ways of shielding and focusing that, you aim it at the guy's tooth, and with the right kind of a detector that you put in his mouth these days, that's a CMOS, I think it is, a detector, you get this picture, and it really tells you what's going on. For a tungsten filament that's heated by current flowing through it, let me drop it, by thermal heating, if you try to create x-rays in that manner, I almost think you cannot do it. I know that you feel that you can, Wes, and now the next question I'm going to ask you is, what magnitude of x-rays? Any object in the world that is above absolute zero in temperature is radiating everything from DC to light frequency-wise, but now you care about the curve. How much energy is at what wavelength, or how much energy is at what frequency? It's a function of how hot it is. As you make something hotter, it generates more and more energy at all frequencies, and it generates the peak of energy at a higher and higher frequency as you make it hotter and hotter. You and I could now figure out, by simple thermal heating of a tungsten filament, what temperature would you have to bring it up to so that near the peak of the curve would be x-rays. And I'm convinced it is way beyond the melting and vaporizing temperature of tungsten. But maybe you feel differently on that one, Wes. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet.
It's not that approach, Dick, N2XJN. We should start from the approach or the energy exchange. Just the energy exchange and energy conversion. And if you try to think about that from the nuclear point of view, you'll find out that mostly manifestation of that energy is in photons. And photons, they are produced mostly in within the range of x-rays. Let me jump. The fluorescent light bulbs produce x-rays. Of course they do. You have a high voltage, you have the gas, and then you might say, okay, what else gives you the x-ray? Well, CRT. It's a fluorescent light bulb as well. And is the x-ray X-ray gun, also X-ray accelerator. And then you would ask yourself the question, well, we have a tungsten in a filament of the X-ray tube, but then we have a tungsten in the light bulb. And then you have a tungsten in the radio tube that was used for many years. What difference is? Everybody knows that radio tubes are what? Electron guns as well. But then, yes, they produce x-rays as well.
Comment, Dick?
Go ahead with your comment, John.
When dealing with CRTs and those type of vacuum tubes that generate x-rays, you're talking about accelerating potentials that are usually above 30,000 volts. That's all.
Yeah. 100% right. Usually. look at the at the phenomena at first, you have to find out that thermionic emission is heat-induced flow of charge carriers from surface over the potential energy barrier. And that occurs because the thermal energy given to the carrier overcomes the binding materials, also known as the work function of the metal. So, in other words, it is an Edison effect. And Edison created light bulb by itself. So when you look at the heated filament of the X-ray tube, and then this is producing a stream of electrons, and the stream of electrons goes to the tungsten, and is able, from the tungsten, due to the attack the K-shelf, and then due to the other electrons from the LMN, whatever, the shelf trying to fit into the K-shelf, and by losing the energy, to fit into the closest shelf, they manifest that in the photon. The photon is in the area of X-ray. So that's how the X-ray is being produced. But...
Yeah, let me add a couple of words on this one now, on what you've said so far, Wes.
But I'm not able to finish that.
Some of what you said is giving the wrong impression. Now, I wanted to address what you've said so far before you go on with three more subjects, though, Wes.
It's like Frank Kill, right? In the middle of the sentence, he's a killer, but Frank killed the bee or the fly, and then now Frank is a hero. So yes, in the half of the sentence, I'm wrong. But what about the rest of the sentence?
For the beep, guys.
In the case of a cathode ray tube, colored television tube, almost all of them contain a very carefully designed voltage regulator, making sure that you don't go beyond approximately 30,000 volts on the picture tube. And by limiting the voltage to 30,000 volts or lower, the amount of X-rays coming off the front of your picture tube is very soft, very low energy X-rays, and so the small amount of lead they put into the glass on the front of the cathode ray tube can easily stop them, and it becomes safe. If they allowed the voltage to go to 100,000 volts, yes, it would be a real X-ray machine, but they don't allow that with that voltage regulator. And when it comes to the fluorescent tube, let me drop. Yes, the striking voltage that first ionizes that mercury vapor inside of the fluorescent tube, in some cases, is a pretty high voltage, particularly for the cold cathode types. But once the beam has been ionized, once you have the ionized mercury vapor inside of the fluorescent tube, it is a beautiful negative resistance. The voltage drop across that beam during 99% of the lighting cycle is around 50 volts. So the instantaneous voltage, 99% of the time, across that fluorescent tube is something like 50 volts. You don't get X-rays out of that. As Eric was telling us earlier, people used to worry about the X-rays coming off a fluorescent tube. They thought they had to coat the glass with lead. They soon realized they were wasting their money and it wasn't required. You do get some ultraviolet light out of that plasma, of that mercury vapor that's in there, that's ionized, and that's the main process by which the ultraviolet light out of the beam hits the phosphor reconverts it to optical, and we get the light out of that fluorescent tube. So, X-rays, fluorescent tube, you could almost say zero. X-rays off a cathode ray tube, color picture tube, you could say very, very low amount. And so, in order to really get the X-rays of an energy that's useful, it needs something like 100,000 volts or beyond, and that X-ray tube in your dentist's office is doing that. The energy that's doing it is as you raise the voltage, the electrons get moved from the cathode. They get accelerated. Let me drop. They get accelerated from the cathode towards that anode made out of tungsten. The velocity at which they hit the tungsten anode is extremely predictable when you know the volts. The electron volts of acceleration is what we're talking about here. So you put 100,000 volts between the cathode and that target, you know exactly how fast those electrons are hitting. And if they hit fast enough, they do make X-rays of a substantial amount. And that beam hitting the cathode would ordinarily burn a hole in it if it wasn't out of a fairly conductive, very high temperature material called tungsten. So it takes very energetic events, as I see it, Wes, to generate X-rays of a substantial amount that's useful. And so talking about what's going on with the outer shell and energy and photons, although it's true, it could give the phony impression that a hell of a lot of very simple procedures are making X-rays. And until you've got the voltages required, I don't think you're making very many X-rays. I may be wrong on that. N2XJM, K2LIW in the TechNet.
N2XJM, well, the whole statement of mine is that most of what we do with energy is production of X-rays as one of the typical phenomena that happen. If you take a electromagnetic radiation that is produced by deceleration or charged particle when deflected by another charged particle, typically an electron by atomic nucleus, the moving particle loses kinetic energy, which is converted into the photon because energy is conserved. Then is a process of producing a radiation. In other words, you don't really have to put the electron in high speed to attack the K-shelf, and then because that K-shelf becomes empty and has a hole in it, the electrons from higher energy shell will try to jump into it, and by that jumping they lose energy and emit X-ray photon, and that's the energy that goes out. By producing electricity or anything or most of the energy exchange, you're actually creating a physical movement of the electron, and the loss of the electron mass of products a photon in that reaction. The interaction of microwaves with matter, with metallic conductors, but also with other than metallic conductors, will rotate molecules and produce the heat as a result of molecule motion, which then specifies not only a creation of the photon, but also the nuclear magnetic resonance that is taking place at the same time. But anyhow, conductors will strongly absorb microwaves, so the amount of X-ray that is produced in this process is minimum. We're talking about production of X-ray, we're not talking about production of X-ray in the amount that is harmful to the body, because most of the matter, including the human body, is largely transparent to microwaves, and is also in certain way immune to the effectiveness of the X-rays that also come from the sun. And to X-ray, yes.
Okay, one of your last statements was that a human being is transparent to microwaves, and the American National Standard Institute C95 report on biohazard, the defining document for the United States, they stated differently, Wes.
30 that largely is
30 to 300 megacycles. What they say is that between 30 and 300 megacycles, the majority of the radio energy that hits a human being between those frequencies is completely absorbed. So 30 to 300 megs, it's all completely absorbed. As you go to above 300 megs toward 1.5 gigs, it's a sliding scale. Let me drop. It's a sliding scale where above 1,500 megs, 20% gets absorbed, penetrates and gets absorbed, and 80% gets reflected. So above 1,500 megs, you're an 80% reflector. Between 30 and 300 megs, you're nearly 100% absorber. That's not very transparent. But the good news is that RF radiation, and there's a real vocabulary problem, which is causing people to get scared of cell sites and cell phones and whatever, and radio transmitters. And 99% of the time, all of that fear is unfounded. Let me and to repeat, you guys have heard this once before, and that is way back around 1900, 1910, when mankind was first studying radio, he discovered you put a radio signal into something you call an antenna, in the beginning called it radio transmission and radio signaling. We wouldn't have that problem today. It's a vocabulary problem. All the radio waves that we use, with rare exception, are not like nuclear, not like X-rays. When those radio signals hit your body, of the portion that gets absorbed, it does nothing but create heating. For 60 solid years, all of those institutions that support the C95 report, the American National Standards Institute, have been looking for the non-thermal effect, and they can't find it, because it probably doesn't exist. Or if it exists, it's in the secondary or tertiary effects. So a radio signal hitting a human being does nothing but create heat. Therefore, let me drop. The amount of allowable exposure of a cell phone is no longer rated in milliwatts per square centimeter, or volts per meter, or amps per meter. It's rated in specific absorption rate, watts per kilogram. In other words, how much heating does that particular radio transmitter create to a human being? As you hold that cell phone against your head, a certain amount of heating takes place of the nearby tissue and brain material and whatever, and it's rated in watts per kilogram. And I think in the United States we're allowing 2 watts per kilogram. I think the United Kingdom is allowing something like 2.6. You rate it at the centimeter level, cubic centimeter level, cc level. However, the units that are used are watts per kilogram. So it's a heating effect. A radio signal, a microwave radio signal, when it hits a human being, of the portion that gets absorbed and not reflected, only creates heating. Nothing else has ever been measured per se as far as to what that report is saying. And that's been the finding document for the United States. It's used by the Department of Defense. It's used by NIOSH and OSHA. OSHA, NIOSH, and the Department of Defense when it comes to defining safe and unsafe RF energy. I'm not going to use the word radiation. RF energy hitting a human being. And until you get above 2 watts per kilogram of heating, then it's relatively safe, per se, by all the measurements that have ever been made. So we get afraid. Let me drop one more time. The word microwave, you say that word in a court of law, or you say it in a zoning hearing while you're applying for a permit to put up your cell site, and everybody thinks that means same thing as nuclear radiation. That's really bad stuff. Each time we go higher in frequency, we assume that it's really bad stuff. And each time we go there, with rare exception in the radio world, we find out it's not true. The guys who experiment with radio will sometimes say, gee, I'm afraid to go that high in frequency. I'm going to get a nosebleed. And that's a joke, of course. But each time you go, I mean, back in the days when Mr. DeSoto wrote his book 200 Meters and Down, we dreamed about getting to 30 megahertz, and eventually we dreamed about getting to 100 megahertz, and we thought all hell would break loose when you go there. The serious guys these days are talking about 241 gigahertz. You go higher in frequency, you don't get a whole lot of bad things, and you're going into microwaves and millimeter waves and sub-millimeter waves, and you think it's now going to start behaving like X-rays and give you cancer. Good-sounding words, misunderstanding of vocabulary, and radio for the most part, until you get to kilowatts values of it concentrated into very small chunks of area and anywhere near as dangerous as you think. We amateur radio operators are the users of this stuff day in and day out. We have to slowly, with our knowledge, educate the community around us to accept the fact that radio is your friend. It is a safe material. And when you declare a 6-month or more moratorium and you won't allow a new cell site to be put into your town of Hempstead or your town of Huntington for the next 6 months, you're denying a safety item that will save lives, and it has no ability to create harm to human beings. If it falls over on your property, yeah, it can put a hole in your house, but it ain't going to happen, you know what I mean? But that's the only danger you've got to worry about. Or maybe what you think is a change in property values because of the unsightliness of it. But to a radio man, a cell site is a beautiful-looking thing. Now, that's another whole area. We'll go there. So radio is safe. We have to slowly convince our community of that. So be careful about the word microwave. And when you say microwaves can be used to heat a piece of metal, not quite sure what you're saying on that one, Wes. If I get a chunk of steel in front of me and I take my horn antenna at 10 gigs, and assuming I have the ability to run a kilowatt, and I aim a kilowatt out of my microwave 10 gig horn, and I aim it at that I-beam made out of steel, 99.9% of that microwave will bounce off the steel, not penetrate. I probably, with a thermometer on that steel, would not be able to measure the temperature increase. So I'm not quite sure what you say when you say the microwave hitting steel is going to make all kinds of changes. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, again, you hear what you want to hear. What I said is most of the matter, including the human body, is largely transparent to my voice. That's true. But high-intensity microwaves, as in microwave oven, where they pass back and forth through the food millions of times, will heat the material by producing molecular rotation and torsion. So what I'm implementing in here is two phenomena. One of them is microwave by itself and its impact with matter. And the second one is the nuclear magnetic resonance as the secondary phenomenon it is taking at the same time. Let me drop.
Hold on, Wes. For the second time in a row, let me drop. For the second time in a row, you said a human being is transparent to microwaves. And I told you that the Zuck curve, traceable to the National Bureau of Standards, published in the C95 report of the Institute of Electrical and Electronic Engineers, the Institute of, what I'm getting at is, that curve shows you how much RF energy at each frequency gets absorbed by a human being. A human being, when those radio waves hit you, primarily is absorber. What's making you say we are transparent? Yes, you and I are transparent below, let me pick a number, 50 megahertz, 30 megahertz. Below 30 megahertz, the majority of it flows through you. You are transparent there. But when you use the word microwave and you use the word human transparency, that curve that's very well respected in this document that's been around for 60 years does not say that, Wes. So only the low frequency, HF, are we transparent. Beyond VHF, beyond 30 megs, you and I are very not transparent. At least the human beings that I meet. N2XJN, I'm having some fun with you, Wes. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Well, then we should say yes. If you question the terms that most matter, including the human body, is largely transparent to microwave, then we should, yes, we concentrate on the band at which that matter or that human body is largely transparent to microwave. As the second part of what I said is high-intensity microwaves are passing back and forth and creating heating of the material. But creating heating of the material is also a energy exchange, and that would be a kinetic energy that will then change the thermal energy in the food by itself. So now we have a physical electromagnetic wave, physical electromagnetic wave, which is the energy and no mass, and is affecting mass by itself. So, yes, small number of the unstable states of almost transparent at certain frequencies, that is one thing. If we think about the microwaves, or microwaves rotate molecules, there's another phenomenon that is happening there, or microwaves at molecular rotation and torsion, there is another the phenomenon that is taking place exactly at the same time with microwave. Question is, what do we want to do? We want to concentrate right now on microwave or talk about X-rays?
AC2IS. Comment, Dick.
Yeah, I heard Bill and John in that order. For the third time, you seem to be saying, maybe you're not trying to say it, Wes, but the person listening to what you're saying and the vocabulary that you're using, you're trying to say, it sounds like you're trying to say, that a human being is transparent to microwaves. Repeater, timeout.
Most matter, including human body, is largely transparent to microwaves. But now we concentrate which microwaves and to which extent. So then I say the high-intensity microwaves, or say certain bandwidth of the microwave in high intensity does this, which is the impact creating the heat. Am I not saying English?
I'm going to say it again. American National Standard Institute C95 report shows that above 30 megacycles, no human being is transparent. Whether it's high power, low power, whatever, microwaves, VHF, UHF, we are not transparent. We are absorbers and reflectors. And when you're cooking your food in a microwave oven, it's primarily the water in the oven, the water in the food, that's absorbing the 2.4 gigs. 2.4 gigahertz is the frequency the microwave oven runs at. For no magic reason, that frequency was chosen because it's left over and not being used. The earliest microwave ovens ran at 900 megacycles. A diathermy machine runs at 27 megahertz. So the water molecules trying to follow the instantaneous radio field flipping back and forth at 2.4 gigahertz is the mechanism by which water absorbs. Human beings have a high percentage of water. That's why we absorb at these microwave frequencies. We're not transparent. It sounded like you were saying that again. I know you were not. Bill wants to make a comment. John wants to make a comment. Bill, AC2IS, I hope we're going to hear you. K2LIW in the TechNet.
This is AC2IS. Hopefully I'm coming in clearly now, transmitting from a higher point. I wanted to ask about the ratiometry stuff you were talking about earlier, and wondering what it would take to construct something that had two antennas, one an omni, one more of a cardioid pattern to tell you when you were pointed towards the signal, when you had a null pointed towards the signal, so you could still hear the signal through the omni, but use the ratiometry to let you know when you were honed in on that signal.
Okay, by the ratiometry technique, could you make an automatic servo mechanism, so to speak, that would allow you to rotate one of those antennas and know when it's aimed toward the source? Yes, very easily, you could do that. And whether you made it automatic or manually operated would be your choice. However, if you're running a ratiometry antenna range for the purpose of getting quantitative data as to the rate of improvement you're making, when you're tuning something like a Yagi, the article will tell you that you get the highest performance out of a ratiometry antenna range when the two antennas are really nearly equal. The reason for that is if the antenna on the left and the antenna on the right are looking at the same chunk of space, they get the same directivity pattern, they're going to see the reflection off the ground the same, they're going to see the power coming out of the transmitter going up the same, they're going to get the same reflections off the devices way off to one side of the field, you'll get a much better reading. If one of those antennas was omni, omnidirectional, it would be responding to some of the signals that went beyond the antenna range, behind you, so to speak, reflected off a tree and then got re-reflected forward and came into the back lobe of an omni antenna. And so you'd get some confusing. So if you want full performance, make sure the two antennas are fairly similar. That's one of the comments I want to make. But the general question you asked, yes, you could do that. And if you're smart, if you can make it work very well, Bill. John, KC2WGB, I know you wanted to make a comment. Go ahead, KQRIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick, a little confused in what Wesley's statement was. It seems that he was saying that if we had, let's say, a 2-gig signal at 5 watts, we aim that at a human, he thinks that it's going to be different, the reflection coefficient's going to be different if we raise it to 100 watts. I think it's going to stay the same. 80% reflected, 20% absorbed. Isn't that true?
Everything I know, John, says that what you just said is true. That the only way it would change is if there was some kind of a nonlinear effect of the water in a human being as a function of power. My particular microwave oven happens to have a variable power control that I can digitally command. I personally have specifically measured the power output of my microwave oven by measuring how long it takes to take 8 ounces of water from temperature A to temperature B when the oven's running full blast. And it calculates to be something like 780 watts. My microwave oven will put into that cavity and cook my food, my water, whatever. And I can dial it all the way back to, I'm not quite sure what the number is, but I think it's something in the vicinity of 10 watts. When I got down to 10 watts output of the microwave oven versus 780 watts, there's a 78-to-1 ratio, and so the water gets heated 78 times slower when I go to the lower power. So the rate at which your microwave oven heats water tells you exactly how many watts are coming out of the microwave oven, and by all the measurements I know about, it's a thoroughly linear process. Double the watts, you double the rate at which you heat something of a known specific heat. Let me drop. There's a little bit of a caveat to that, and that is, if you study the specific heat of water, and you go to the right website that gives you this information, you'll find out the specific heat of water is very slightly temperature sensitive. In other words, how fast you can heat up water at 0 degrees centigrade, 30 degrees centigrade, 80 degrees centigrade changes a little bit, but it's a second order effect. But except for that, water as a load for a microwave oven running at high power or low power is apparently a very linear process. So if the rate at which the water in a glass is absorbing microwaves is essentially independent of the power, and the human being has a high percentage of water, therefore, as I go to high or low power microwaves and I expose a human being to it, the rate at which I heat up the human being is, in theory, very predictable. That's the reason why the current, let me drop, the maximum permitted exposure numbers that are used for cell phones are in units of watts per kilogram. And they didn't tell you whether or not you're allowed to run high power, low power, big antenna gain, small antenna gain, close spacing, far spacing of the cell phone, just that under normal use of the cell phone, after you figure out what power it's transmitting, what loss it's got of its transmission line, what efficiency it's got of its antenna, what gain it's got of the antenna toward your head, how close it's located your head, you put that all together. The bottom line is, how much heating did you create for that human being in units of watts per kilogram? And if it's below 2 watts per kilogram, everybody's happy, and you can manufacture that product. N2XJN, K2LIW and the TechNet.
Well, when I right now, in this few minutes that are left over, we'll start to talk about microwaves. I mean, I have a defending material, but what I'm saying is a microwave oven are time dependent. That means the less power, the more time is required. But also, I was talking about microwave density. So maybe that's the difference in understanding of English. But what I want to say is that if the matter is made up of atoms, and atoms have electrons that orbit around the nucleus in shells, all we need to do is get the electron free of their orbit. So how we could do that? Very simple way. We can take a piece of conductive wire, pass the current through it. The wire will heat up due to the resistance in the wire. The heat of the wire excites the electron, and they will break away, boil off from the wire to extend the energy picked up from the heat or the current. So when the energy of the electron is expanded, it will return to the wire to become a heat again. It's a typical what's happening when you put a current into it. So the heated wire serves as a source of the electrons. That's what is happening in the X-rays wave. That's what is happening in your tungsten light bulb. That's what is happening in the radio tube, the pentode or triode, whatsoever. It's exactly the same one. We have a production of electrons. And by that token, if we then have those stream of electrons bombarding any metal, specifically tungsten or another tungsten, then the X-ray tube is done this way, that string of electrons is heated the tungsten anode and is getting into decay of the shell, and then because of ejecting the electron out is creating the X-rays, because other electrons from the higher shells will try to fill the gap because they feel comfortable because of mutual attraction to the closer to the nucleus where the protons are, and protons are 1800 times more bigger than the electron. That's what I was trying to say, that the energy exchange almost every time produces a photon, and that photon is almost every time in the range of X-rays. I'm not talking about the electron volt level of them, but they are there.
If I heat up a filament, and you're saying it's boiling off electrons, yes it is, and if I've got a nearby electrostatic voltage, like a plate of a tube, an anode nearby with high voltage on it, I can suck up those electrons if and only if it's in a vacuum. Those electrons that get boiled off from a hot piece of metal don't get a chance to go anywhere. They hit a local air molecule and it's game over, if you know what I mean. So only in a high vacuum do you get that stream of electrons. And you said before it is density. Well, yes, it's power flux density, watts per square meter. That's 4 watts per kilo, correction, the 2 watts per kilogram of specific absorption rate that's allowed for a cell phone in the United States. That's the bottom line. You make a sham, you make a phony human being, you make a model of a human being, you create this phony brain material out of the right kind of gelatin that has the same absorption rate as brain material, and you put the thermocouples, temperature sensing devices in it, and you turn on your cell phone on the outside of this dummy, and you start measuring what are the watts per kilogram that occur inside that human being, and whether or not it exceeds that number, assessed over each individual cubic centimeter. However, when you figure out that 2 watts per kilogram, what does it really mean? It is a power flux density. It is a density thing. At the surface of the head of the human being, it's in the vicinity of 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. So you could rate that in milliwatts per square centimeter, 10 milliwatts per square centimeter. You could rate it in volts, 192 volts per meter. You could rate it in magnetic field, half a volt per meter, half an amp per meter. Unfortunately, in that
repeater, time out.
Unfortunately, in that
2LDY.
Unfortunately, and 2LDY recognized me there in a minute. Unfortunately, in that tiny little space you've got between that cell phone and that human head, you can't easily put instrumentation in there to measure milliwatts per square centimeter, to measure volts per meter, or to measure amps per meter. Even though those units are there, it's a very difficult place to get to. But you put that instrumentation inside of that sham head, that dummy, you can easily measure the amount of heating that occurs, and therefore that is the bottom line. I mean, all those measurements can be done with error because of the reflections of the human being and the reflections of the antenna and everything else. How much heating do you create of that brain material? And if it's below a certain number, by everything we know in the United States and the United Kingdom and Japan and Australia and all the other places that have these very similar sounding standards, if you keep that heating below that number, it's considered safe. Because radio energy, no one has ever found any non-thermal effect. Radio energy hitting a human being or hitting water creates heat. If the heat is below a certain number, it doesn't create injury, it doesn't create anything else, and we're happy with it, and it's a safe thing, and it's very helpful to human beings. N2LDY. Start off with your name, sir, and your comment. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Handle is Dawn, Delta Ask November. Just a real, since we're on microwave discussions here, real quick question, maybe you can explain, or maybe at another time. Let's say I take a piece of, a slice of pizza, and I throw it in a microwave here, and I hit like a minute, and I take it out. Normally, the edges are all nice and hot, or overly hot, and the center isn't. Can you explain why the you know, the item that you put in there would cook from the edges inside.
Yeah, my wife and I have this discussion fairly frequently, Don, and you're into a delicate area. I'm going to try to explain it. In the case of cooking the pizza in the first place, you start off with these hot coals in the oven running at something like 600 degrees Fahrenheit, and now that is a thermal oven of a known temperature, and you put your pizza in there, and the way the heat spreads through the cheese and the dough and the tomato sauce and everything else is very predictable. Okay, now you take that piece of pizza the next morning out of the refrigerator, and you decide to heat it up in your microwave oven. And now it's a very different environment. First of all, the microwave oven doesn't heat at a rate as a function of temperature. You take your thermal oven, and you set it at, let me pick a number, 300 degrees Fahrenheit, and you set your piece of pizza in there for a given length of time. Maybe that length of time is 1.5 minutes, and it brings your piece of pizza, every bit of it, up to a particular temperature by the thermal effect. But now you put your piece of pizza in the microwave oven. Let me drop. And two or three other things are happening. That microwave oven, if you turn it on full blast, my particular microwave oven, it's going to turn out 780 watts, plus or minus a little bit. It's going to dump 780 watts somewhere. Okay. If I put a great big heavy glass of water in there, 8 ounces of water, all of that energy is going to go into the water, and in 1 minute it's going to raise it to, I forget what the number is, 60 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. Because your pizza is an extremely light object in mass compared to water, the total amount of mass there is much smaller. Therefore, the same 780 watts for a minute and a half poured into that tiny little weight of that pizza slice is going to do some very different things. It's probably going to overheat some area and underheat some other area and so on. And the areas that it heats most are the area that has the most amount of loss tangent. The tomato sauce has got water in it, and that's absorbing the microwaves quite well. Depending on how dried out the dough is, it might have no water and not respond at all. The cheese is a milk product, and the milk product doesn't have as much water and doesn't absorb heat the same way. So you get some kind of uneven heating. It's about the best you can do. Let me drop. If you set the microwave oven at a low enough level, if yours has a variable power output rating like my Panasonic one does, you set it at a low enough power rating, even though individual portions of the pizza are being heated at a different rate, if you do it slow enough, the thermal conductivity within the pizza will even it all out for you. You try to heat it real fast, some little portion of that pizza is going to be burning while the other part is still ice cold. So heating things in a microwave oven, it's a brand new art and science compared to your thermal oven, as you can see, Don. It behaves very differently. It's not because of its error. And if you took your piece of pizza and raised it above the floor with a piece of foam so that it's further away from the wall, it's a flat object close to the floor, and there you get a very peculiar microwave field. Let me drop. And the turning of that turntable tries to even it all out. The real microwave oven has got hot spots. Those waves are bouncing around in there, very similar to what happens with that handy talkie in your hand. You walk around the room when you're far enough from the repeater, and you find out there are certain dead spots. There are certain places where the wave from the left and the wave from the right come together and cancel at that one particular point in space at 146.85 megahertz. And at some of the points, they've got a peak. Well, you've got those peaks and valleys in your microwave oven, and by that turning of the turntable, they try to even that all out for you. But if you put your piece of pizza on something like a piece of foam that raises it another couple of inches above the floor, it will be a little bit more even. So raising it above the floor will help. Setting it at a lower power level will help. Letting it at a lower power level for a longer time will give you a more desirable result when you're heating up that piece of pizza. Wonder if it makes some sense, Don. N2LDY, K2RIW.
thanks a lot, Dick. Yeah, excellent description. I really appreciate that. And let me just, so I'll sign out now, because I think it's going to end soon or something. So thanks again, Dick. This is N2LDY in the group.
Dick, WJTV with a comment.
WJTV, K2LIW, by the way, what you guys just heard is the tail end of TechNet number 1458. We intend to be back next Sunday and discuss more microwaves, among other things. WJTV, K2LIW, go ahead.
I just wanted to jump in there and let you know that the Brookhaven National Labs open house, I remember we discussed it last year, I don't know if you got a chance to go, but they're having the National the Synchrotron Light Source tour a week from today, next Sunday, and I believe that's the only day that they're having that kind of tour. I think it's the regular one and the one that's under construction, the two version.
Very fine, Joe. Joe, what time of the day is that tour, and is there more than one tour? Do you have to sign up ahead of time? I'd like to go to that. WJ2B, K2LIW.
It opens at 10 o'clock, and it's over at 3, and I believe you go to the main gate, you show them your driver's license, they give you a pass, and you park in the main building, and then they have a little table that you go up to, and you sign up for the tour, and then they have like a little presentation in the room next to where the table is, and then they let you line up to do it. You got to get on a bus, and then they take you over to the building.
I thank you for telling me about that, Joe, and that sounds like a good thing. Am I correct in assuming you are an employee of Brookhaven Lab, or you just a guy that keeps track of what they're doing? Go ahead.
I know people that work there, but I am not an employee, but I have gone to these open houses, for the last few years. I've seen that they actually had a really nice one for the National Weather Service office there. They actually showed the balloon, when they send up that radiosonde balloon every few hours, they showed that. For some reason, they're not doing the National Weather Service tour anymore, but they did a few years ago. It was really good, and they had some ham guys out front, too, with the Skywarn guys. I saw Walter RGI was there and a few other people that I recognized. And they seem to cut the tours back a little bit. They used to have 5 or 6 Sundays that they used to do it. Now they're down to 4, so they're starting to cut the program back a little bit. So, if you really want to see the Synchrotron Light Source next Sunday, probably be a good time to see it. They also had some other tours of some of the other buildings. I think they're still going to do the nanoparticles and the other one of the other buildings. They actually have a website about it. If you go to bnl.gov and then you look under Summer Sundays, you can find it on their website.
I thank you very much, Joe. And because I'm not smart enough to keep track of that, I'd like you to tell me each time they've got an open house. Each time I've gone to Brookhaven Lab, maybe get a chance to walk around any of the buildings and look at just the plaques that are on the wall, the great big wall charts, so to speak. Boy, they've got some interesting stuff. They do some good work. So please keep me informed, and thank you, Joe. WJ2B, K2LIW.
Very good, Dick. Yeah, I'm going to try to go to Synchrotron Light Source tour also. I don't know what time I'm going to go. I'll probably try to get there as early as I can because it's probably going to get a little crowded. It's usually pretty crowded near the end of the tour. It's like around the 1 to 3 area. The best time is probably to get there around the 10, 11, a little bit before lunch. It's not as crowded.
Very fine, Joe. Okay. Bye-bye, you all. And we'll see you next week. TechNet Live. That's what I think it is. Just like, who was that? Larry King Live? We got TechNet Live. And one of the live guys is John. KC2WGB for any other comments? K2IW. Go ahead, John. John, do you have the ability to...